Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, this is our last podcast of 2010. Let's hear it. I know the listener is overjoyed. And let's just say that as we have in the past, we will bow to tradition and use this final podcast of 2010 to say goodbye to those who said goodbye in 2010.
There were many of them, and they were not all people who were successful in politics, but they all touched us. They all leave memories behind. And we have a list here, maybe of 20, 25 people. They're not in any chronological order. No presidents.
No vice presidents.
No, but we had the wife of a vice presidential candidate, Elizabeth Edwards.
Now, that was one that we took note of on an earlier podcast this month with the sad passing of Elizabeth Edwards and the tragedy of that particular family story. But there have been many other people over the course of this year, some of whom had been in power long ago and had been largely forgotten. Others were still very much in their prime of power, and I'm including here John Murtha, a man who had been the powerful, I mean, the word was always used in connection with him, his middle name was P, and he himself liked to say it stood for powerful, chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense.
Yes, and he was the Prince of Pork. I believe he was the first Vietnam veteran ever elected to Congress, but I still remember when he was elected in a special election in 1974, the first Democrat to win that seat in Pennsylvania's 12th District in many, many years. People said, uh-oh, the Nixon administration and the Republican Party is in big trouble because of what this election represents. Murtha basically filled a role in 1974, but he grew into such an enormous, larger-than-life figure that he was one of the giants when he passed away, still, you know, with the Democrats still in charge.
Dying unexpectedly from complications from an operation that he underwent early in 2010 and creating a vacancy both in his district, which was filled by a Democratic candidate.
Again, if we're talking about powerful, there's Dan Rostenkowski, who also was a former chairman. He was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the 1980s, early 1990s. Very powerful South Side Chicago Paul, you know, been there for a long time. Grew up with the organization, the big Mayor Daley, the first Mayor Daley. Note to kids, there used to be another Daley who was mayor before this one.
That's right, and he was not mayor for quite as long as the current Mayor Daley, but he was mayor forever in Chicago terms. All right, John Murtha was getting into trouble for some of his activities in steering money back to his district in Pennsylvania at the time that he died. Dan Rostenkowski's trouble arrived much sooner. In 1994, he was targeted for an investigation for some of his activities in the House. And in the same year that he was actually defeated for re-election, he was also nailed by the federal attorney, the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., for a number of the things that he was doing in his office that essentially amounted to stealing government property, chairs, stamps, a lot of petty stuff, really.
It was petty. I mean, to think of the power he had and the fact that he nickeled and dimed his way into prison, that was pretty remarkable.
Especially because he had been a major figure and a highly effective legislator. Not everyone agreed with his policies, of course, but it was his cooperation with Ronald Reagan back in 1986 that produced the last bipartisan tax reform we've had in the United States Congress and the model for what President Obama is saying he'd like to see done in 2011 and 2012.
You know, two other former House members who passed away this year, Stephen Solar is the Brooklyn Democrat, big in House Foreign Affairs Committee. He was the one who uncovered the fact that Imelda Marcos had 3,000 pairs of shoes. But another person whose name, perhaps you may not remember him with what he did in Congress, but you remember him afterwards, is Charlie Wilson.
Charlie Wilson became famous in a movie. Charlie Wilson was a well-known personality when he was a Democrat from Texas back
good times, Charlie.
In the 1970s and 80s, and known for his lifestyle and for his good humor and his many friendships.
And women in his office.
Yes, in particular. And so when this movie was made, Charlie Wilson's War, starring Tom Hanks as Charlie Wilson, most Americans had long since forgotten this particular congressman. And so it was something of a revelation to realize that people used to behave in quite such a, well, such an old-fashioned manner.
Right, sort of the way we do it on the podcast. But Charlie Wilson, what he did do in the movie and in real life is that he was one of the driving forces to get aid covert or not, whatever way he could do it, to the Afghan rebels battling the Soviets. And, of course, these are the same Afghan rebels who are battling the United States forces in Afghanistan today.
They may not be literally the same, but the movement clearly gave rise to the Islamic movement that followed and certainly passed on some of those arms. And now the Taliban today is something of a descendant from the Mujahideen of the 1980s. All right, we're really wallowing in a lot of the past here, but that's kind of the nature of this last show. We're looking back over the lives of some of the people who left us in 2010. And we've mentioned several people in the House. Let's talk about a couple of senators. I know Charles Mathias was close to your heart. I believe he was your senator, Ken.
Yes, actually. When I did move to Maryland in 1986 from the great state of New Jersey, Charles Mathias was in his final year as a Republican liberal. Let me say those words again. Republican liberal. There are not too many Republican liberals in the Senate or on Earth.
I would say that there is no one in the Senate not been anyone in the Senate since the 1980s as liberal on the Republican side as Charles Mathias.
Charles Mathias was called by Mike Mansfield, who was the majority leader at the time, the conscience of the Senate, a liberal Republican, a good guy. When he was elected in 1980, to this day, he's the last Republican who was elected to the Senate from Maryland.
You know, I also remember the 1984 Republican convention in Dallas, Texas, where they were renominating Ronald Reagan for president. And Charles Mathias came to town with the rest of the Maryland delegation and was refused a seat because he was so unpopular with the Reagan forces that were ascendant and dominant at that particular convention. So a symbol of the past in the Republican Party, and certainly the trends that we saw in the 2010 election suggest it's going to get further in the past.
Another a senator who certainly had much more clout. Matter of fact, he probably had more clout than any Republican senator in history. That was Ted Stevens of Alaska, who died in a plane crash this summer.
Ted Stevens, of course, had left the Senate in 2008.
Not voluntarily.
Not voluntarily. He was defeated for re-election in an extraordinarily close election. He was defeated by Mark Begich, who's the senator from Alaska today. And Ted Stevens also, of course, the reason he lost that election was that he had just been convicted on a series of counts of corruption by a jury here in the District of Columbia. Tremendous irony that the next year, the Attorney General, appointed by President Obama, Eric Holder, caused to be dismissed all the charges against Ted Stevens, on which he had been convicted and then, if you will, diselected by the people in Alaska because of prosecutorial misconduct, an extraordinary story that has continued to have ramifications since. One of those prosecutors who was accused of misconduct subsequently committed suicide. It was quite a story. And this past year, it got yet another dimension. It got yet another chapter when Ted Stevens' plane went down between two stops in Alaska.
And in a sense, the 2010 Senate race in Alaska was a referendum on Ted Stevens' kind of politics, because Lisa Murkowski was the kind of person who liked the pork coming into the state, the federal largesse and things like that, whereas Joe Miller, the Tea Party Republican who won the Republican primary, said what Ted Stevens did for those 40 years in Congress, by the way, he served longer than any other Republican in the history of the Senate, Ted Stevens did. Joe Miller said this is the kind of politics that we no longer believe in. That's true about the Tea Party, but ultimately, Ted Stevens' legacy actually won out in the end, assuming that Lisa Murkowski does win that seat.
Yes, and it appears that she has the suit that Joe Miller filed to try to have the votes recounted appears to be going down. While we're talking about Alaska, we can't miss this opportunity to mention Walter Hickel.
Walter Hickel, of course, was first elected governor in Alaska in 1966. He was what was most interesting is that during his first term, he left early to become President Nixon's Secretary of the Interior, and he also left the Interior Secretary job early. He left the cabinet early because he was fired by Nixon because of comments he made opposing Nixon's stance in Vietnam. Very controversial, very outspoken kind of guy. And later, in 1990, he was re-elected governor of Alaska on the Alaska Independence Party, which is almost like a pro-secession party, but Walter Hickel, one of the founders, again, along with Ted Stevens, one of the founders of the Republican Party in Alaska, and a giant figure there. But, you know, whenever you think of Ted Stevens on the Republican side, what I think of a pork and the Democratic side, nobody better than Robert Byrd.
That's right. And getting back to the Senate, you mentioned earlier that Ted Stevens was the longest-serving Republican in Senate history. The longest-serving senator in Senate history, the granddaddy of them all, was Robert C. Byrd. And he died this past year after a career stretching back to 1958. in the United States Senate. He, of course, served for many years as the minority leader, as the majority leader, and also as the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and finally as president pro tempore of the Senate, which makes him third in line to the presidency, and he held that job into his 90s.
You could not go anywhere in the state of West Virginia without seeing a Robert C. Byrd Highway, a Robert C. Byrd Courthouse, a Robert C. Byrd
bus stop.
A bus stop, exactly, anything. The first time I think I ever heard of Robert Byrd was when the centrist wing of the Democratic Party put him up against Ted Kennedy and beat him
for majority whip after Chappaquiddick.
After Chappaquiddick.
Which was when we knew that they were taking Chappaquiddick fairly seriously in the Senate and that they were not taking Teddy Kennedy as seriously as they would later. And it was also, of course, a great breakthrough for Robert Byrd. He was also an exemplar of the kind of internal Senate politics that now seem to be pretty much dominant in choosing the leaders. They don't necessarily go for their biggest siege gun or their smartest member or their future presidential nominee or anyone like that. They seem to go for somebody who is willing, content to focus on the details of running the Senate and keeping all the senators in his party happy and negotiating with the senators from the other party.
They said nobody loved the Senate, nobody knew the Senate, nobody knew the rules as well as Robert Byrd did. Of course, I think as much as people respected him and were in awe of him, they never thought he would be somebody who moved up. Remember, as a youngster, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He voted against, for example, Thurgood Marshall. He voted against the Civil Rights Act. I mean, he had a really strong anti-civil rights record in his early years in the Senate. But once he became part of the leadership after 1971, he seemed to be more of the National Party, although he did make an aborted 1976 bid for president for the Democratic
Very
nomination.
Very little remembered.
Got absolutely nowhere. That was his one attempt at the big prize.
Yeah.
You mentioned also for a second about Ted Kennedy and Chappaquiddick. One name to throw in there, Edmund Dinis, D-I-N-I-S. He was the district attorney in around Chappaquiddick, and he was the one who basically investigated that accident in summer of 1969 when Ted Kennedy drove off the bridge, Mary Jo Kopechne died, and actually he was defeated for re-election because they felt he was just too favorably inclined for the Kennedy family.
I love the fact that you know that. Some of the big figures that died in the past year, a former cabinet member who got famouser than he had ever been before in 1981, Alexander Haig.
Well, Alexander Haig, of course, he was also already famous because he was the NATO commander. He was also Richard Nixon's chief of staff.
Briefly, toward the end of the presidency.
But early in the Ronald Reagan presidency, when Reagan was shot in a tennis assassination attempt in Washington, Alexander Haig had these famous remarks in the White House briefing room.
Constitutionally, gentlemen, you have the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state in that order. And should the president decide he wants to transfer the helm to the vice president, he will do so. As of now, I am in control here in the White House.
And of course, Haig was the secretary of state at the time, and judging by the Constitution he had read when he was in high school, he thought he was next in succession if the president was incapacitated by gunfire and the vice president was, well, somewhere flying around being kept safe for a little while. He felt he was the number one person in the government, at least in the White House at that time, mistakenly. And even if it had not been mistaken, there was something about the style in which this man, whom most people are still associated with the military, stood there in a civilian suit, but looking every inch the general and with that hauteur and announcing himself to be in charge. That's unforgettable.
And he certainly wasn't in charge of his, in 1988, when he made a bid for the Republican presidential nomination, going nowhere and ultimately endorsing Bob Dole, who also went nowhere. George H.W. Bush won that year.
Not a happy ending for the political career of Alexander Haig. A few other people we'd like to mention, and one that I particularly would like to mention, is Ted Sorensen. He went to work for John F. Kennedy when Kennedy was a young senator in the early 50s, and Sorensen was a recent college graduate and law school graduate coming from Lincoln, Nebraska. The two men could not have been more different. Their backgrounds could not have been more different, and they had a perfect mind meld, and Sorensen provided the kind of gravitas and intellectuality that Kennedy craved but didn't necessarily have himself. Kennedy, of course, provided all the glamour and all of the other powerful elements of a successful presidential candidate in 1960. And the two of them wrote together a book, Profiles in Courage. They wrote many famous speeches, some of which have gone into the pantheon of American rhetoric right alongside Abraham Lincoln.
And, you know, in all the years since 1963 and the horrific events in Dallas, every time you see Ted Sorensen, every time you think Ted Sorensen, you think of that young guy who served in the White House, that brief 1,000 days he served in the White House. And actually, Ted Sorensen ran for office himself, ran for the Senate in New York.
Very ill-advised campaign, lost in the primary.
He did.
It was a sad coda. Again, I mean, many of these figures had their finest moments when they were in their proper lane, if you will, in their proper role in politics, and then when they ran for office themselves, did not fare so well. Remembering back to the 60s, let's point to a couple of other figures. Stuart Udall, the influential Secretary of the Interior under President Kennedy.
Right, continued into President Johnson. Of course, when he left the Congress to become Interior Secretary, his brother Mo won his congressional seat. But Stuart Udall was a true conservationist, big inroads in the environmental community, died this year.
Another figure I remember from the 1960s, Benjamin Hooks, Ben Hooks, later the head of the NAACP.
15 years ahead of the NAACP, long-serving, sometimes controversial figure in the NAACP. And if we're talking about race relations, I thought there was nobody better, and probably nobody better to NPR than Ron Walters.
University of Maryland scholar.
Yes, a great guy, a wonderful guy, always bailed us out when we need, but he knew the politics of race better than anybody, and he was a really just great guy to know and to talk to.
I still reach for his number every now and again. And of course, while we're talking about NPR and people who have meant a great deal to us, we must, of course, end with Daniel Schorr.
Daniel Schorr, of course, his reputation was cemented long before he came to NPR, but we who knew him and we who saw him in the hallways all the time were just privileged to know him. And whether we were talking about 1973 or 1993,
or 2003.
Exactly. Dan Schorr was always a delight.
Always the man. And that's it for this week's political podcast. And because we will be dark next week, that's it for this year's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Happy holidays to you too, Ken. Join us again next year for It's All Politics from NPR.